Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi, alayhi salam, the 10th divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Now, one of the things that was very prevalent in the time of Imam al-Hadi, alayhi salam, it was something that, you know, people were confused about, specifically the religious scholars and the ulama of the Ahlul Sunnah, especially because they were disconnected from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam to a certain extent. They were confused about certain things such as compulsion and free will. And so one of the things that they were really stuck in was this idea of compulsion and free will. What's interesting is in this conversation, of course, which is a long conversation, we find that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he starts to bring up various verses of the Holy Quran in which His Eminence talks about how Allah will punish the disbelievers, He will punish the kuffar, He will punish those who commit sins, because Allah told these people to not commit these different offenses, yet they went ahead and they committed those offenses, and so now they are liable for punishment. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam talks about compulsion, and he talks about how, you know, if Allah is going to punish these individuals, then He cannot force these people into committing sins, because this would, you know, eventually mean that Allah is unjust and Allah is oppressive, because He is punishing people for sins that they were forced into doing. You know, and really doesn't make any kind of a sense. So Imam al-Hadi, he talks about verses of the Holy Quran, and eventually he kind of closes off this whole idea of absolute compulsion, again, by listing some verses of the Holy Quran. Eventually he says that we, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, say that Allah the Almighty rewards people for their doings and punish them for their doings, that they do with their own will and ability that Allah has given to them. Allah has enjoined the people to do some things, and He has forbidden people from doing other things. That things which Allah has enjoined the people to do, when the people do it, out of their free will, they are rewarded for these things, and this is just and honorable on the behalf of Allah the Almighty. And on the other hand, when the people prevent themselves from doing those things which Allah has forbidden them from doing, then again Allah rewards that individual, because out of their free will they prevented themselves from doing those things which Allah had forbidden them from doing. But on the other hand, if the individual goes ahead and does those things which Allah has prohibited, then of course they are liable for punishment. And Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam again brings up a verse from the Holy Quran talking about the mercy and the justness and the compassion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, where the Holy Quran says, whoever brings forth a good deed, we shall reward them with 10 of that like. But whoever brings an evil deed, we shall recompense them with the like of that one deed, and no one shall be dealt with unjustly. And finally, he, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, talks about how every soul shall be rewarded for what they have earned, and no justice shall be done to them on the day of justice and the day of judgment. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After days of pause in Yemen's naval operations, the spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of an Israeli ship in the Arabian Sea with multiple missiles. He said that the attack followed the drone and missile strikes against U.S. warships in the Red Sea.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces launched an attack on the Israeli ship MSC Sky sailing in the Arabian Sea with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The missiles hit the vessel in an accurate and direct manner. The operation came only hours after Yemen's armed forces targeted a number of enemy American warships in the Red Sea with a number of ballistic missiles and drones.
Experts say this operation sends a message to the US and UK that Yemen's armed forces are still capable of targeting Israeli-bound vessels in the regional waters. Despite their aggression against Yemen, they believe that the Yemeni army has not used its new weapons yet, which will be another challenge for the Western powers.
Yesterday's operations and the targeting of the Israeli ship and the American warships is a message that the Yemeni armed forces will continue their operations against the enemy. No matter what the Americans do, whether political or military moves, we will continue with our strategic options until the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. The Yemeni army will carry out more strikes and steal has big surprises for the enemy in the coming days, unless the enemy stops the brutal aggression against Gaza.
On Saturday, the British cargo ship Ruby Mar, which had been targeted by the Yemeni army last month, sank in the Red Sea. The sinking of the Ruby Mar has raised concerns about the potential ecological damage to the Red Sea and its coral reefs, as it was carrying more than 41 tons of fertilizer and had leaked oil for several days after the attack.
Yemeni officials hold the US and UK fully responsible for any pollution resulting from the sinking of the British ship. They assert that Washington is the one militarizing the Red Sea, supporting the Israeli war on Gaza and depriving Palestinians of humanitarian aid, which are the main reasons for Yemeni naval operations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The right to speak out, to protest, the very fabric of democratic rights, once again under attack in the UK, as the government updates its definition of extremism and is about to introduce a potential ban on parliamentarians joining protests. Recommendations from the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, also known as Lord Walney, who is a former chair of Labour Friends of Israel, call on leaders of the mainstream political parties to instruct their MPs to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop, quote, hate on marches. In the crosshairs, climate activist groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who have organized the enormous peaceful mobilizations for Gaza since October last year.
This is an affront to democracy and an indication of a weak and decaying government's descent into authoritarianism. It's totally out of touch with the British people and actually very much out of keeping with the British values that they claim to champion.
Ahead of Walney's recommendations and after the by-election in Rochdale, Greater Manchester, that handed pro-Palestine campaigner George Galloway a thumping victory, a speech by the Prime Minister vilifying the pro-Palestinian protests demanding a ceasefire in Gaza.
In recent weeks and months, we have seen a shocking increase in extremist disruption and criminality. What started as protests on our streets has descended into intimidation, threats, and planned acts of violence.
Critics say comments like those about peaceful demonstrations are a threat to the long tradition of freedom of protest and expression in the country.
His assertions are totally false. I mean, you know, the claims of an increase in anti-Semitism, of extremism, there is no evidence for that. I mean, this is just pure invention and another indication, frankly, of how weak this government really is. To have a special address to the nation as if there was some sort of state of emergency. Some people that spoke to me thought that we'd declared war on Russia. What it was George Galloway, the leader of the Workers' Party, getting elected as a Member of Parliament. I mean, that should be celebrated, not attacked in that way. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
The new changes are yet to be announced and legislated, but the political temperature is rapidly rising in the UK.
In its 2024 World Report, Human Rights Watch says that the UK government's practices and policies have severely curtailed domestic human rights protections. Others say the country is at risk of turning into a police state masquerading as a democracy. The question now is, how deep will those erosions go? And will the MPs in the building behind me allow them to continue? Saeed Puriza, London.
Iran has held a final round of a national moot court to stimulate taking proceedings against enforcers of unilateral sanctions and those who comply with them. The session was held by Iran's Institute of Judiciary in cooperation with the country's High Council for Human Rights in Tehran. Speaking at the event, the secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that sanctions were considered weapons of war and even more destructive than a war due to their substantial impacts and being a collective punishment against a targeted country's people.
Undeniable rights cannot be ignored in sanctions, and implementing global peace and security cannot be possible without taking such rights into consideration. The legality of the legitimacy of sanctions is an important issue that the Security Council must consider in the discussion of imposing sanctions. Meanwhile, the international community has not yet accepted the legitimacy of unilateral sanctions.
Elena Duhan, UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, also delivered a speech at the session via video conference.
In the situation of Iran, the most absurd cases refer to the impossibility to deliver bandages for EB patients from the only monopolist producer in Sweden, and similarly impossibility to deliver the medicine necessary for thalassemia patients suffering from some sort of autistic state, as well as some sort of psychological and physical diseases, especially if we are talking about the rare ones or the most severe ones. As a result, these are patients which are not directly designated by any type of sanctions, which are deprived of any possibility of access to health care system.
Meanwhile, speaking at the session, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said sanctions were the biggest crimes against humanity and were a collective punishment and proof that those who pursue and promote unilateralism do not respect human rights.
Iran is among the countries under the U.S. cruel sanctions, which is making efforts to restore the country's rights as a national duty. Sanctions arise from the international behavior and phenomena, and they disturb the future security and stability of the world. For a country which imposes sanctions, international law or human rights are not important.
Iran has been under U.S. sanctions for the past 4 decades. The sanctions intensified following the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from a 2015 nuclear deal in May 2018, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Iranian authorities have repeatedly blamed the U.S. sanctions for shortage of medicines that treat special diseases like cancer. Health officials have warned that the harm caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran's access to pharmaceutical supplies may even get worse in the future. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed the readiness of the Lebanese resistance to face any possible Israeli aggression against Lebanon. He said any Israeli act of aggression would trigger an advanced version of the 2006 war, when the Tel Aviv regime suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of Hezbollah.
The Zionist enemy continues to threaten us with military aggression. We respond by means of steadfastness, resistance, and retaliatory strikes. We hereby declare that if they commit a foolish act and attack our territories, there would then be a new version of the July 2006 war.
He warned Israelis that Hezbollah would fight in an even more sophisticated manner in any future confrontation, stressing that the outcome will eventually be a victory for the resistance fighters. Sheikh Qasem was speaking at the 6th International Conference for the Union of Resistance Scholars in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Representatives of the Palestinian resistance factions also stressed that the United States' all-out support for the Israeli warmongering policies has given a cover to the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities as its genocidal Gaza war has marked 150 days. Hamas official Osama Hamdan stressed that Muslim nations are duty-bound to foil U.S.-Israeli plots against war-torn Gaza.
It is the duty of Arabs and Muslims worldwide to take the initiative and foil Israel's conspiracy of starvation. The countries neighboring the Gaza Strip must not stand idly by and should take a concrete measure, especially for Gazans in the north.
Scholars and thinkers from diverse Muslim countries have come together to voice their support for the Palestinian people and the resistance. They sent a message of solidarity for Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as Israel's unbridled and unfazed brutality continues unabated.
50 scholars, top scholars from 25 countries, they are gathered here, and hopefully they will reach to any kind of the solution, kind of support and solidarity for the people.
The Palestinians are sending a very strong message. Then look, you be answerable to this. You know, the accountability is not only in Israel who are the murderers, but accountability should also be there among the Muslims. Why are you not doing anything? So that's why Palestinians are giving that voice. They are struggling, they're saying they're going to fight to the end, and therefore they say if you want to help, it's your responsibility, it's not we appealing.
With the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza now in its fifth month and over 30,000 civilian fatalities, scholars in Beirut assert that the resistance in the region has no choice but to continue its armed struggle until the final victory.
The Muslim clerics in support of the resistance have stressed through their discussions and meetings here in Beirut that the Palestinian cause is a reason for unity and solidarity. They say the teachings of the Quran have drawn a roadmap for supporting the Palestinian people in their struggle to free a land considered holy to all Muslims. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A series of restrictions were imposed on the Yemeni economy following the U.S. redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group earlier this year. This blacklisting has had an impact on the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country, where millions of people are in dire need of aid.
Ansarullah as a political component has no external economic relations or companies in the private sector that have real weight in the national economy. The real goal of the resolution is to blackmail Ansarullah and distort their position in support of Gaza. The Yemeni economy has been in a state of siege for 9 years, and therefore the American measures putting pressure on the local economy we believe will not have much effect, especially since the Yemeni economy has withstood pressure over the past years and adapted to the measures imposed by the exiled Yemeni government in Riyadh. The Central Bank of Yemen will also work to impose procedures to secure the transfer of foreign exchange to and from Yemen.
Several international companies, including the money transfer company Western Union, have suspended their activities in Yemen, severely affecting the livelihoods of most Yemenis who rely on financial support from relatives abroad. Experts predict that such actions will lead to the creation of a black market for those benefiting from the suspension of money transfers.
The United States of America imposed collective punishment on the Yemeni people. Very important financial channels were stopped, such as Western Union, which is one of the most important money transfer networks in the world, and through it, Yemeni expatriates in American and European countries used to send money to their families in Yemen easily. We have 6 million expatriates outside the country and thousands of Yemeni families depend on them to provide a living. You can imagine what the situation will become after these financial transfers stop. The beneficiaries of this measure are black market workers who exploit these circumstances by deducing a percentage of their remittances and transfer them through illegal channels.
In an effort to deter Yemen's naval operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the U.S. Department of State blacklisted the Ansarullah movement as a specially designated global terrorist group. However, this designation has primarily affected the humanitarian situation, as members of the Ansarullah movement have no investments abroad.
Observers believe that Washington's recent measures are aimed at inciting the Yemeni people to take to the streets in opposition to the Ansarullah movement as a strategic move to undermine the group's popularity in the country. But that plot does not look like it will succeed, given the widespread support for Ansarullah in Yemen.
It was the second occasion on which Pakistani lawmakers elected Shehbaz Sharif as the new premier of the country. Shehbaz Sharif assumed office as Pakistan's prime minister for the first time in April 2022, following the dramatic ouster of Pakistan's jailed ex-prime minister Imran Khan from power through a parliamentary no-confidence vote. Sharif, the younger brother of Pakistan's three-time Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, secured 201 votes in the lower house of the parliament. He emerged victorious over his rival Umar Ayub Khan of the PTI party, led by jailed ex-PM Khan, who managed to secure 92 votes. A candidate needs a simple majority of votes in the 336-member house to win the post.
From the deepest core of my heart, I thank those who with their votes and love elected me as the leader of this house. People have been given a split mandate in the general elections, and those having reservations about election results need to approach the appropriate forums. We have no personal egos, and the other side also needs to follow the suit for the sake of Pakistan.
The election of the new Pakistani premier was marred by nationwide protests by the supporters of imprisoned Imran Khan against alleged rigging in the recently held elections. Several party workers who were staging protest demonstrations against results manipulation in the recently held elections were arrested.
I am here to request Election Commission of Pakistan, the Judiciary of Pakistan and Chief Secretary of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to take strict action against the ROs, the DROs, who not only violated the Election Act and election rules and oath of their offices, but also violated Constitution of Pakistan, in which preamble states that the people of Pakistan will decide the fate of their representatives through ballot.
The newly elected Premier Sharif, who is expected to take the oath of the office on Monday, has been congratulated by several neighboring countries, including China, Iran, and Turkey.
As Shehbaz Sharif assumes the role of Prime Minister for a second time, he is pitted against a multitude of challenges. These include fragile economic and political conditions. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean doctors rallied Sunday, threatening to go on strike following the government's decision to increase the quota for incoming medical students from about 3,000 to 5,000. Doctors say the measures will not necessarily alleviate the shortage of physicians in less desirable specialties and locations.
In essential medical care, the conditions are relatively poor and there are legal burdens such as frequent criminal lawsuits compared to non-essential medical care. It cannot be said with certainty that the increased number of doctors will flow into essential medical care and rural medical care.
Triggered by the government plan, 9,000 resident doctors in training out of 13,000 across the country walked out on February 20th. Patients have been scrambling for care with hospitals understaffed.
The government wants to win the general election by winning votes from the people, and that is why it is ultimately implementing populist policies without making a scientific or rational decision and without any preparation.
Polls suggest the South Korean public largely supports the government, and President Yoon Suk-yeol has seen his approval ratings increase since the standoff with doctors emerged. The government has filed criminal complaints against the leaders of the Korea Medical Association who organized this rally. Doctors who failed to comply with the back-to-work order face the suspension of their licenses, fines, and potential jail sentences. Both sides appear to be digging in. Medical schools don't have the capacity to accommodate so many new students, say some administrators. National Assembly elections are scheduled for April 10th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
Self-purification is the most significant fact
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
مرحوم سید بحرالعلوم علامه بحرالعلوم رو شما همتون میشناسید
You might have heard the name of the famous scholar of Islam, Sayyid Mahdi Bahrul Ulum. He was known by the title Friend of Imam al-Mahdi. The late Sayyid used to live in the city of Najaf in Iraq. Contemporary to Sayyid was the late Mullah Mahdi Naraqi who lived in Iran at that time. Mullah Mahdi Naraqi was also a great scholar and jurist of Islam.
یک کتابی نوشت به نام جامع السعادت که الان کتاب هست تو بیرون سه جلده عربی هست
ملا مهدی نراقی compiled a book titled جامع السعادت This book is about Islamic morality and ethics One volume of this book reached the city of Najaf and the late Sayyid Bahrul Ulum. The late Sayyid took the book and looked at it carefully. Upon seeing the content of the book, the late Sayyid prayed for the author and admired it very much. The late Sayyid used to say, "This book is a remedy to spiritual and ethical maladies." The empty place of such a book was filled by Shia population and scholars. May Allah bestow his blessings upon the author of such a book. This was how the scholars respected each other and their works in the past. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech. which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
نزل القرآن يهدي للتي أقوم ويبشر المؤمنين.
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین الحق ليظهره على الدین كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزای لازمی است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough
نقیم الدین ولا تتفرقوا فیه
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran Quran Quran
کتاب الله
In the limelight.
Official records show that Jeremy Hunt, the UK Chancellor, has been forced to contribute more than £100,000 of his own money to his constituency Conservative Party to bolster his chances of re-election. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. For the past few weeks, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, has had a clear mission. Under pressure from Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, he and his Treasury officials have been poring over their options for pre-election tax cuts that the Prime Minister is convinced are needed to give the Tories a fighting chance at the forthcoming general election. However, had Hunt consulted his own constituents, he might have come to a very different conclusion about what he needs to prioritise in the coming days. A recent opinion poll in his new Godalming and Ash seat, a brick in the blue wall, now under attack from the Liberal Democrats, suggests Jeremy Hunt is on course to be the first serving Chancellor in modern times to lose his seat in the House of Commons. According to a recent survey poll commissioned by campaign group 38 Degrees, the Liberal Democrats are currently on 35% of the vote, the Conservatives back on 29% and Labour on 22%. With tactical voting, the Chancellor could be an even more distant second place. But the findings also suggest that, far from being enticed back to the Tory fold by tax cuts, his own constituents prioritise the woes of the National Health Service above all else. Asked to identify the issues determining their election vote, health and the National Health Service came top, followed by the cost of living crisis and the economy in general. Only 4% of the voters said tax was a key election issue. Among his local voters, an alarming 59% said close friends or family had experienced difficulty in booking a GP appointment, and almost half had struggled to book an appointment themselves. To hammer home the point, two-thirds or 67% of voters of those asked said increasing funding for public services such as the National Health Service would be more important in determining their vote. 25% said tax cuts would be more important. Matthew McGregor, the chief executive of the 38 Degrees Group, said, "Under Jeremy Hunt's chancellorship, lives have got worse in Godalming and Ash. It's as simple as that." McGregor added, "This election is a chance for change and all parties need to listen up. The public wants our National Health Service to be saved and they want help with the cost of living crisis. They don't want cheap tax tricks to buy votes and ruin our essential public services." The findings show that before one of the most crucial political weeks of his long career, Jeremy Hunt finds himself stuck between three competing and contradictory realities. The first is the political reality that tax cuts of some kind have been so priced in that number 10 it's clear that they have to be delivered in some form or another. But beyond Westminster, the reality of the pressure on public services is troubling voters, including Jeremy Hunt's Godalming electorate. Then there is the unwelcome economic reality that Jeremy Hunt is dealing with. However the Chancellor chooses to find the cash for tax cuts in the coming days, with number 10 Downing Street pushing for a cut to the basic rate of income tax, and the Treasury preferring a cheaper national insurance reduction. There are now increasingly despairing warnings that they will be based on future public spending commitments that are a complete fantasy. Hunt, thought to have about £13 billion headroom within his own fiscal rules, has been looking at finding more cash by dialing down already very tight future spending plans, cutting any increases from about 1% a year to 0.75%. Economists believe it is almost impossible to achieve such small rises given the pressure facing public services, but the desperation with which tax cuts are being pursued means that Jeremy Hunt may have to deploy such a suspension of disbelief. David Gough, a former Tory Chief Secretary to the Treasury, said that the low spending plans in place already amounted to a hospital pass to the next Chancellor. He said, "Nobody really believes that is going to be deliverable. There are two grounds on which conservatives try to distinguish themselves from Labour on the economy. One is that conservatives will be more fiscally cautious, and second, that they would deliver lower taxes. Particularly at the moment, those two attributes are in tension with each other. David Gove, a former Tory chief secretary to the Treasury, noted, "This is probably his last big job and this is probably his last budget. If I was Jeremy Hunt, my priority would be ensuring that his reputation and the Conservatives' reputation for good economic management is enhanced, not diminished, rather than trying to gamble that a big tax cut would be transformational, which I don't think it would be." There is one other pre-election trick to play. Included in Jeremy Hunt's pre-budget options have been plans to steal some of the few revenue-raising ideas that the Labour Party has committed to. An overhaul of their tax status and increasing the windfall tax on energy companies. That would spike Labour's guns. But with the right already critical of Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak, there is a very real political danger that such a move will do nothing to help the Prime Minister regain control and authority over an increasingly ungovernable Conservative Party.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadamiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan.
Mulawi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly lives of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, personalities, ulama and scholars during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the fuqaha of the 13th century Hijra, one of the most outstanding students of Muhammad Hassan al-Najafi and Sheikh al-Ansari, Mirza Habibullah Rashdi. He was famous for nurturing so many outstanding students of the houses of Najaf and Iraq. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Mirza Habibullah Rashdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. About Mirza Habibullah Rashdi's biography, what we can mention here is that his father was Mirza Muhammad Ali Khan, son of Jahangir Khan Qochani Gilani, one of the most famous Shia scholars in his time. So his ancestors were originally from Qochan, who were forced to move to Gilan in early 7th, century. And he was born in 1234, and of course in one of the villages of Gilan, which is a province in northern part of nowadays Iran.
Yes.
And he passed away in Jumada Thani in 1312, and of course then in Najaf al-Ashraf, and was buried in one of the rooms around the country yard of the holy shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's right. Sheikh Fadai, now the major question is that so many of the outstanding scholars of Islam, especially the Shiite ulama and fuqaha, left their hometown in order to migrate to another country, Iraq, on that time, especially the cities of Najaf, Samarra, and Karbala, in order to attend the courses of outstanding scholars over there. It seems to be a very hard travel and difficult travel, especially on that time, without facilities. What motivations do you think they had to do so?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We can say that the main difference between religious knowledge and non-religious knowledge is that in religious knowledge, the scholar feel a very deep responsibility.
Yes.
But usually in non-religious knowledge, people and the scientists think about themselves more than the others. Of course, they benefit other people as well. But the main focus is on themselves in order to improve, in order to gain some wealth, to have a good life, and beside that, to help some people as well. But when people enter the sphere of religious knowledge, they think about other people more than themselves.
Yes.
When you feel this deep responsibility, we can say that you pass from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can tolerate every difficulties.
Yes.
Our scholars were like that.
Mm-hmm.
When they felt this responsibility that we as the scholars of religion have to teach this religion,
yes,
and preach this religion, so we have to tolerate a lot of difficulties. One of the difficulties was that migration. As you mentioned, this migration was not easy. At that time, for example, moving from Rasht, or Gilan, as we call,
yes,
it, the province, Iranian province,
yes,
to other country like Iraq,
yes,
by, I don't know, horse and camels.
Yes.
And even
unfeed him.
Sometimes
right.
Unfeed.
Okay. Yes.
Usually with their families,
okay,
with their wives, with their children.
Yes.
And among a lot of diseases.
Wow.
Among a lot of thieves,
yes,
in the ways.
Yes.
You know, they had to pay a lot. They had to spend a lot of time.
Yes.
Maybe these might migration spent for 6 months or 1 year,
yes,
to go to
on the way to go to Najaf,
yes,
or Karbala. That's
but you know,
okay,
now we just read in the books that they migrated from this country to that country. That's
okay.
It.
Okay.
But it is not like that.
Yes.
They I want to say that they felt their responsibility,
mm-hmm,
because of that. They did that. For example, if you check the teachers and the students,
yes,
of these great scholars, Mirza Habibullah Rashti,
yes,
you can see that this chain of scholars, these are the famous ones that even now in our Hoza we are benefiting from them, we are using from their knowledge.
Yes.
What is the common point?
Mm-hmm.
The common point is that responsibility.
That's right.
From professor and teacher to the students, again from that students as a teacher to his student, they transfer this responsibility. For example, Muhammad Hassan Najafi, nowadays in Hoza we call it Sahib Jawahir.
Yes.
And Sheikh Ansari.
They were the teachers.
Yes, the authors of Rasail and Makasib.
Yes, yes.
You know, Jawahir, Rasail and Makasib are the main,
yes,
books,
yes,
textbooks in Hausa. These are his professors and,
mm-hmm,
teachers. And then about his student, Sayyid Muhammad Kazimi Yazdi, we know it as Sahib Urve.
Yes.
Aghaziya Araghi, Mirza Naini.
Yes.
You know, this is a chain.
Yes.
They are the, I can say, the scholars that felt that responsibility,
uh-huh, okay,
and tolerated all the difficulties in order to transfer that legacy of religion to us, and nowadays we are using that legacy because,
yes,
of their,
okay,
hard working.
That's right.
That.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is harshtoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, when we look at their personal, individual life, we can find them very much humble. The people who never were after reputation or something. For example, they say that Mirza Hibullah Rashti was among the best students of Sheikh Al-Ansari, but after the demise of the Sheikh, he never accepted the position of Marja'iyah or Za'ama, as better say, custodianship and guardianship of the houses, and referred the people to Mirza Shirazi on that time. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of their religious personal life, Sheikh.
Yes, about the, let's say, moral characteristics of these great scholar, there are many points that could be mentioned. One of these that is that his special moral characteristic made him a very pious kind of personality.
Yes.
Was famous for his asceticism.
Yes.
He always remembered Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and seized any opportunities to recite the Holy Quran or prayers and supplications. And he was so careful and cautious that he could not easily answer the questions that he was asked without complete research. And he was so respectful toward Mirza Shirazi that he encouraged people to ask their question from him and to be his followers, muqallid, not muqallid of his own self,
yes,
muqallid of this Sayyid. Mirza Shirazi, I mean.
Yes.
Although he was the top student of Sheikh Al-Ansari, but of course, as you rightly mentioned, after his demise, he did not take, let's say, Shari'i funds, I mean, khums or wujuhat,
yes,
okay, and never actually showed the slightest desire to become marja'i taqlid, even when his student insisted on his becoming a marja, but yes, he actually directed them towards Mirza Shirazi.
You mean he was the marja, but he was,
he was
not,
yeah, he was only
accepting the,
marja, the, he did not,
yes,
accept
official
his
position of the custodianship of the Hawza on that time.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
There were lots of these kind of scholars, even Sayyid Ibn Tawus, rahmatullah,
yes,
alayhi, was also the same,
yes,
that he did not answer the fiqhi questions.
Yes. Uh-huh.
He also tried in his life not to not to interfere any to any kind of fiqhi or jurisprudential,
uh-huh,
kind of,
okay,
issues.
That's right.
Because not becoming a marja'i taqlid. So the same case is with this great scholar.
That's right.
This is the moral kind of characteristics of many of the Shia scholars that could give us lots of lessons,
mm-hmm,
particularly the students of Hawza and the ulama of this modern time.
That's right.
Of the Shayu, yes.
And one of the interesting points about the life of Mirza Hibullah Rashti is compiling a kind of book typically known as Hashiya, or the marginal notes or explanations to great books of his masters, Sheikh Al-Ansari and Muhammad Hassan Al-Najafi. Badayu Al-Afkar, which is a hashiya on Najat al-Abad of Sahib al-Jawahir, is one of them. So what was the need to write such explanations or marginal notes to great books of the teachers, Sheikh Fadai?
You know, in the system of Hausa, it was like that you go to the classes of a professor,
mm-hmm,
you use from him, but you never stop. You don't want to just imitate what he said. You don't want to just stay at that level.
Yes.
They always try to improve the borders of knowledge.
Yes.
You know, Hashiya or marginal notes,
yes,
has two aspects. The first aspect is to explain what the teacher said.
Okay.
Why? For example, we say that he was one of the top students of Sheikh Al-Ansari or,
yes,
Muhammad Hassan Najafi. So he could understand what his teacher Sheikh Ansari said better than us,
uh-huh,
and even better than the other students at that time.
Okay.
First of all, he wanted, and not just he, Habibullah Rashti, as I told you, in the system of Hawza, it was like that, and even now it is like that. First of all, they want to explain what the professor said at the class.
Yes.
In order to stop and prevent misunderstanding from the lessons of the professor. The other aspect is to improve the border of knowledge. Maybe after reaching the level of ijtihad, especially after this level, maybe the student doesn't accept some of the ideas and theories of the teacher.
Uh-huh.
So they never like that to copy all the theories of,
yes,
the teacher.
Okay.
For example, in our Hawza, we have Ayatollah Jawadi as one of the
great mufassirs, the students of Allama Tabatabai.
Yes.
You know, people who don't know about these two great scholars think that so Ayatollah Jawadi is his students of Allama Tabatabai and he copied all the theories of Allama Tabatabai.
Yes.
But if you go to his lessons, for example, what I did,
yes.
When you go to his lessons for several years, you can understand that he has various different ideas.
Uh-huh.
So marginal notes, one of the aspects of marginal notes is
well,
that
it's better to say he adds some new perspectives
yes.
to the old, for example,
as I said,
materials.
Improving the borders of knowledge.
Yes.
A good student never main a copier.
Yes.
Never main an imitator.
Yes, yes.
This is the science.
Yes.
And it is interesting that we can see in the history that in the age of 25, he reached the level of ijtihad. You know, ijtihad is not something easy.
Yes.
If we want to compare with the degrees of our knowledges in universities nowadays, at least ijtihad is a combination of 10 doctorates.
Yes.
At least.
Okay.
In the, ilm of fiqh, usul, rijal, diraya, I don't know, philosophy, and in ilm al-hadith, a lot different. He should be a master at least in 10 field of studies. In which age? In the age of 25.
Yes.
You know, our scholars were genius once.
Yes.
And why? Because they tried a lot.
Yes.
You know, they never thought about, I don't know, how much income I have. And nowadays in Hosea University, if we want to study, first of all, we think about income.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to study, how much can I get? If I cannot have a good life,
yes.
I would leave these studies.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, you know, our legacy of Hosea was not like that.
Yes, okay, that's right. Thank you very much. Sheikh Rouhani, has anything missed?
Not actually the points mentioned regarding this great scholar, yes.
Okay, thank you very much for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Mirza Habibullah Rashti. He passed away on Jamadi al-Sani 14th. It was Thursday, 13-12, in the city of Najaf at the age of 78. His body was taken into one of the we can say chambers or rooms around the holy tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he was buried in the holy courtyard of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the city of Najaf. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. May Allah protect the following generations of the scholars who still are busy with nurturing students all across the Islamic houses around the world. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.